because of the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad. Again.
The greatest manhunt there's ever been.
Do you remember the Whitewater investigation in Arkansas? All the paperwork was stored in the Murrah Building.
Peace.
A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995, will change forever the way you look at the true nature of terrorism.
The grand jury did not want to hear anything I had to say.
The decision was made not to pursue any more of those individuals.
The greatest manhunt there's ever been.
Do you remember the Whitewater investigation in Arkansas? All the paperwork was stored in the Murrah Building.
Hey, somebody knew about a prior bomb threat.
Every bit of important evidence has brought us to the Oklahoma City bombing.
Expose, cover up now.
Hey folks, this is Tom, RTR Truth Media, Resurrected Republic, Public Broadcasting Network. I'm on the line with Chris Emery, who is did an incredible documentary with a number of other partners called A Noble Lie. And before we really get into it, I'd like, Chris, if you could explain to our audience, for those who may not know or may be hearing this for the first time, what exactly is A Noble Lie by definition?
Well, it was taken from Plato. It's a series of statements or alleged truths that are known to be false to dupe or deceive the general public into believing what the government wants them to believe. Plato said that's the Greek government was very good at doing that and lying to their citizenry all the time. So what we did is we took that and put it into our title, Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995, because what we found out as a film crew that the official narrative of the Oklahoma City bombing was patently false, and it was our job to try to figure out what really happened, and I think we did a fairly good job with the film.
Oh, I watched it several times, and one of my good friends who is also very interested in this topic is Brian Young over at High Impact Flicks. We've been discussing this for a couple weeks now, trying to get everybody on the same page at the same time. On the same screen was difficult, but I'd like to, he's going to be watching it again with his wife, and we're going to be really trying to share this with people, because I think a lot of the information that you uncovered is a lot of things that people are experiencing to this very day, and they're not really realizing what they're seeing when they see a lot of these reported official stories. This isn't a conspiracy theory that you share. I want to make this really clear with people that may not be familiar with this. You know, when we do a video on Oklahoma City and we post it to YouTube, for instance, that you'll see at the bottom of the video is the Wikipedia article on the description of the official story of Oklahoma City. And it just blows my mind how they just keep propagandizing people. In fact, wasn't it law enforcement agencies themselves that differed in their opinions on whether
absolutely. Yeah, we found from our research, the local county and state law enforcement in Oklahoma were pretty much in agreement. It was the federal government, the federal law enforcement, the FBI field office and the headquarters, actually, in Washington, D.C., that came in and told these guys how to do their job. Even the local FBI field office in Oklahoma City was very upset. We talked to their public information officer, several of the secretaries, the functionaries, the IT employees. And if I can expound on that, the first 6 months I was in Oklahoma City, I moved there in January of 2003 after taking a hiatus in New Mexico for a year just to put my head around the subject and put the outline together. What I found out that if you can put a kind of relate yourself to what happened here, these people had their close friends, some family members that were killed in the bombing. And for their superiors from Washington to come in within 4 hours after the bombing happened and tell them how to investigate the case, tell them what the marching orders are, tell them what the official narrative was. That was, it was the height of arrogance and hubris, and it was very humiliating, and it was a kick in the groin and a slap in the face to the law enforcement, the local, and the city, and the county, and the state level. So there was that undertow, that animosity that existed even up until 8 years later when I arrived in town to start work on the film. And when they found out that our crew was in town, and one by one, they were coming out of the woodwork, either by emails or by phone calls or showing up at 7-Eleven already, a dinner at breakfast at Denny's, wanting to help us out, the support was absolutely unbelievable. So that was my boots on the ground experience of seeing how the federal government, and some people, not all of them, but some, they're very high at the top of the food chain, will come in and tell these people how to do their job. And it was absolutely disgusting what was going on.
Well, of course.
On April 19th, 1995, at 9:02 a.m., explosions tore through the Alfred P. Myrtle Building in downtown Oklahoma City, ripping through the consciousness of America. 169 people were left dead and hundreds more injured. The Oklahoma City bombing was the largest act of terrorism on American soil until 9/11. America had a new demon. We're now being told that this demon is emerging from its slumber. Since that day of horror, groundbreaking new information has come to light. So provocative, so explosive, that it threatens to shatter everything we thought we knew about the true nature of terrorism.
We'll pursue every lead and use every possible resource to bring the people responsible to justice.
I was sitting at my desk there on the 8th floor. I felt the building start shaking, lights went out. Debris started falling on my desk. Something hit me in the back of the head and knocked me out before the truck bomb went off. What that tells you is that there were other explosive devices in the building that actually brought the building down.
It's an earthquake. Everybody get down on underneath on the floor. And I had sat there and I thought, no, it doesn't feel like an earthquake. 7 or 8 seconds later, I felt this explosion.
Only an imbecile would look at that damage pattern and not understand that it couldn't have been made by a truck bomb, because a truck bomb is going to release its energy simultaneously in every direction.
The record clearly shows that Dr. Jolly and West consulted Timothy McVeigh's defense team. Dr. West had previously been psychiatrist and consulted for Patty Hearst, Saran Saran, and Jack Ruby.
We know that Jolly and West was considered to be the number two mind control expert in North America under only Dr. Ewing Cameron. We know that he was McVeigh's doctor from the time around the trial to the time he was incarcerated in Terre Haute, Indiana, and then executed.
Even though the spin was, it was the right wing, it was the militias, McVeigh was involved in all this stuff, he did it because of Waco, and you know, all this stuff that the media was pumping out, none of it panned out. The militia in those days would have guarded the Murrah building. Now, they wouldn't have guarded the UN.
I wrote a letter to the district attorney, Macy, told him what I had seen and that I wanted to testify in the grand jury. I got a letter back from him telling me that the grand jury did not want to hear anything I had to say about the bombing.
It is every patriotic American's duty, every man, woman, and child's responsibility to research the facts contained in this film, to verify for yourself that this information is true, and that the rabbit hole goes even deeper, and then take action to bring the criminals that perpetrated this attack to justice. If we don't, they're going to win and bring down our republic in the process.
Of course, the thing that I see happen time and time again is that they move in and they seize everything. They try and withhold evidence. They try and cherry-pick evidence to create a narrative. And this is time and time again. I know that it's been a short time since you've been able to review the short clips on Schaefer Cox and Jeffrey Reinhouse, but it's the same. This FBI, and I want to say that there's compartments of the FBI that I have a lot of respect for. There are
same here.
Yeah, the ones that go after the serial killers and the one. I mean, they. I really do believe that there's really good people in the. If not, they wouldn't be able to stand at all, right? So,
right.
But then they have these compartmentalized or politically driven people at the top, and I see this happening. You, like with the Bundy trial, for instance, just a short example. The willful withholding of exculpatory evidence, regardless of what you think about Mr. Bundy, the case, or anything, your right-left doesn't matter, right-left paradigm aside from this. The judge, who was a liberal judge, prosecuting a bunch of what she considered right-wing conservative, you know, whatever, turned to the prosecutor and castigated the prosecutor for willfully withholding exculpatory evidence, shredding evidence, the Bureau of Land Management. So these federal agencies, like the FBI, have become the modern-day standing armies, a Stasi force. What the FBI involvement here, the pre-knowledge that was going on here, there's a couple things that bother me. One is the Elohim City, the Southern Poverty Law Center informants that were given information. Can you touch on the Southern Poverty Law Center and their involvement in this?
Well, there's one individual in particular that we know of, Andreas Strassmeier, whose dad, Gunther Strassmeier, was the former chief of staff for Helmut Kohl, which is their equivalent of the German president, very highly revered. I know the German citizenry held him up on the pedestal almost like we do with George Washington. That's how well-respected he was. His former chief of staff was Andreas's dad. We know for a fact that Al Gore, vice president at the time under Bill Clinton, asked the German government to help the United States infiltrate neo-Nazi groups in the United States. They sent Andreas Strassmeier from Germany to help the United States law enforcement authorities, the Department of Justice, and the FBI infiltrate. It was rigged from the word go. He was in LOM City. What Strassmeier was not aware of is that there were also informants and operatives for the CIA and the FBI in the same compound. They did not know of each other. Now, he did know of Tim McVeigh. That's for another conversation another time.
Yeah.
So
well, I have a question there that not to interrupt you, but it's important. If the FBI had people there, the CIA had people there, and the Southern Poverty Law Center had people there, and nobody was none the wiser to who was who and what was what, my question is how many people at Elohim City were even authentic?
Exactly. And as Jesse Trinity said in a quote under the film, the attorney that we interviewed, he says, if you have six people in a militia or a right-wing group, typically at least half, if not two-thirds of them, are working for the federal government in one capacity or another on the payroll. Well, the head of LOM City, Behan, and the superior that was ahead of it were actually getting $500 a week or $500 a month from the FBI. I mean, it was a joke. It was rigged.
Yep. Well, we see the same thing that happened with Schaefer Cox I told you about. He was running for political office in Alaska, you know, just a background. He was very popular. He was talking about Constitution. He went to the Constitutional Convention. Very popular young man who had this crazy idea that, you know, you can actually raise a militia. He was very peaceful and nonviolent, but he had it with the corruption in Alaska, both federal and state. And there is, I never realized until I started looking into a couple cases like the Heggs case and other cases, but this young man was set up. There were paid confidential undercover FBI informants that were used not only to set him up but to craft a narrative that was used to convict him for, get this, plotting to kill agents that did not even exist, right? So this conspiracy to commit murder of federal agents and all of this business, they cherry-picked a couple things out of recordings, but they withheld all of these FBI recordings in his case. They withheld them. The judge allowed them to cherry pick little portions from these confidential undercover informants and some dialogue because they were setting up a violent situation. And Schaefer was like, no, I'd rather kind of go Gandhi with this, not Rambo. Right. But they wouldn't let that into trial. Right. So we see this. It's almost like this court system between the FBI, the prosecutor, like with Bundy's case I had mentioned. Willful withholding of exculpatory evidence. What happens to this prosecutor? The judge, a liberal judge, who we thought was going to crucify Mr. Bundy, for instance, turns to the prosecutor, which, by the way, was, I believe he was another Obamaite, and mm-hmm. you know, nothing happens to these people. Nothing. There's no accountability. Every once in a while, they throw us some kind of peon or a scapegoat or something, but...
Right.
But the Southern Poverty Law Center and the FBI and their relationship and this undercover thing is very interesting to me. One of the things that I find very interesting is how a white supremacist group used Waco as its banner to retaliate against the federal government when Waco was an interracial Christian community. And the actual psyche, if you're an actual true to your roots white supremacist, that's not something that you would get involved with defending.
That's correct.
So that was one of the narratives that it's like the planners of this, whoever it was, to me, does not seem authentic for that and many other reasons. Maybe you can give me a couple other examples.
Well, all right, Strassmeyer, we do know that he was infiltrating a militia group in Texas before he went to LOM City. Certain members of the militia were suspect and thought Strassmeyer, there was just something that wasn't right. They followed him at 2 o'clock in the morning to the federal courthouse in downtown Fort Worth, watching him punch in the security code and the keypad in the back door of the, by the loading dock in the courthouse. And they confronted him the next day and says, you have 24 hours to get out of the state or you may not be alive. Literally, we are going to shoot you. And he got out of Texas and then he ends up in LOM City. That's how dumb he was. He's a complete fool in that respect. But the other, examples, I mean, you're right. I mean, it could go on and on and on. Southern Poverty Law Center is an organ, is a direct link to the FBI. It's one of their several efforts, and certain members of the FBI, don't get me wrong. Like I said, there's a lot of good people that helped us out with the film, and we're going to give credit where credit is sure. due. But to this day, it is a part of the Justice Department and the FBI that is used to foment conflict and, like you said, to create situations out of whole cloth that simply aren't true, that are fabricated, to justify the very existence and the budget of certain parts of the FBI. It's a vicious circle. Yes. It exists. That's the way it happens. We saw it in Oklahoma City. 9/11, certain parts of that were the same thing. It happens. If your viewers have an issue with that, they're welcome to contact me. I can run them through several examples, but we're not making this stuff.
No, I'm glad that you mentioned that, because I've been in communication with a fellow that you and I talked about. His name is Gary Hunt, and we've kept up conversations going back and forth.
Sure.
And there's been, he's come under scrutiny, and there's no secret to that. He freely admits that. But one thing that I agreed with him with, was, you know, take somebody like you. You really investigated this, so well. So this is the way, really, this is what media should be in America. That's exactly what should happen. So I propose, because he makes a few compelling arguments, but he admittedly had not seen your documentary when I spoke to him. I sent him a link to it, and I can't, that kind of surprised me a little bit. I was surprised that he hadn't watched that yet, being so well versed in it. He was one of the guys, he said, David Koresh's power of attorney. He came to Oklahoma City. You're familiar with who I'm referring to?
Yes, and he was mistakenly identified as being on the scene of the crime. Yes. We found out that he was not there.
Yes, I found out the same. That I came to that same conclusion too. And one of the reasons I think that it's important for us to keep an open dialogue in these things is that he's made a number of points, and I would very much like, as in perhaps a follow up interview in the future, if we can get everybody together and just have a conversation about it. I think that is really what the freedom of speech is all about, is to be able to sit down, have a conversation cordially and discuss these issues. Nobody really knows them from your investigation as well as you do. I mean, there was also footage, I understand, that didn't even make it into the film. Are you planning on releasing that in the future? Or?
Well, here again, it's a matter of a production cost and getting the crew back together. The archives are there. It's going to be quite an effort to gear that all back up again. We'd love to do it, but the cost is going to be substantial. And if we have the resources available, yes. It would take probably about a year and a half to create such a follow-up documentary again.
Well, I'd ask my listeners and anybody who shares this, if you could, now I'm going to leave links in the description where you can go and purchase not just A Noble Lie, but several other wonderful documentaries that were put out by Free Mind Films. And, you know, we're gonna share with our audience a couple of the points. I'm gonna few some clips in here.
Let me just throw out the website. It's simply freemindfilms.com. The homepage, we have the posters, the artwork of all three of our films, and on that is an embedded link that our graphic artist put together, did a wonderful job, which will take you directly to the Amazon Prime pages for all three of our films. Very simple, one click. You're there, and then it gives you the option to rent, purchase. So yes, we would definitely appreciate that support. Thank
yes.
you.
Yes, and all those links will be provided below for folks to to click on. Please use them and purchase the film. Don't get a bandit copy. We want more. This is something that's really important. If you really want to support independent investigative journalism, pay for it. Don't be afraid to pay for it. So anyway, well, let's move forward. Another one of the things that I wanted to discuss was Mr. Trinidad. That whole situation just ripped my heart out, what he went through and what his brother went through. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. Kenneth Trinidad was a former bank robber, and he was sentenced to serve his time. Reporting to the parole officer, he's from Southern California in San Diego. One of the conditions of his parole is he couldn't drink. Well, Kenny liked his beer. So he continued to drink beer, not in an irresponsible way, but and then started not reporting to the parole officer. This is after he served his time robbing some banks in California. Anyway, he was stopped at the Mexico border because at the time his girlfriend was living in Mexico and he was on his way down to visit her and her family. And he was brought into custody and sent to the Bureau of Prisons as a transfer facility in Oklahoma City. By geographic default, it is actually about 200 miles off the dead center of the United States. Con Air uses that airport to transfer inmates through the Federal Bureau of Prisons from east to west coast and all points in between. Well, he was brought to Oklahoma City, taken into custody and processed through. And he was there for about 4 days, gave his brother, Jesse Trinidad, who is an attorney at Salt Lake City, civil law and sports attorney, he called and says, look, I'm in lockup. Jesse said, okay, just keep your cool. You know, I'll have you out here. We'll get you co-counsel. And Jesse did hire actually a very good attorney out of Oklahoma City to represent Kenny. So this is August 21 of 1995. We're talking 4 months and four days after the bombing. Within 3 days, Kenny was found dead. Now the official story was that he hung himself and he cut himself. Well, that wasn't true. He was beaten. He was tortured. Had ligature marks on his throat. He was literally strangled.
Yeah, I've seen the photos. They were just incredible.
Yeah, it was horrendous. Yeah. Horrendous.
How anybody in their right mind could not come to the conclusion that that was torture. And then it went back and forth between, you know, what was the doctor's name? I can't remember his name off the top of my head. But
It was Fred Jordan. He was actually the medical examiner at the time. And of course, Dr. Jordan still had his hands full with the aftermath of the Oklahoma City bombing. We got to talk to some of his subordinates at the medical examiner's office. So not only were we dealing with the cache of information from the victims of the bombing, a clear-cut separate case with Kenny Trinidad and the horrendous treatment of what happened to him. All of the evidence, the T-shirts, the blood samples, everything were destroyed. They weren't processed correctly. Fred Jordan was furious about that. Dr. Jordan said it was an open homicide case. I mean, there was no doubt about it. This is a professional. He's a state medical examiner, has more power than the governor of the state to rule on matters of death and homicide and suspect homicide. So I never got to talk to Dr. Jordan. He had since retired before I moved there. And last word we knew, he retired and moved to upstate Maine. Just wanted to get geographically and mentally away from everything in Oklahoma City. So, but long story short, Kenny was tortured. His feet were beaten. He was unbelievable, just shot up with caffeine to make the pain even more acutely worse
Isn't
than it was.
Isn't great?
And, well, in fact, one of the inmates, who was a trustee in the same cell block, saw at least three, if not four, federal officers go in with full body armor and just take it out on Kenny. Kenny didn't have a chance. So the photos proved it. In fact, we found out that the warden, a female warden at the time, freaked out when she found out Kenny was there under an assumed name, by the way, Paul Brockway, one of his aliases that he used in the bank robberies. They processed him through an alias, which we couldn't figure out. We're not quite sure why.
Yeah, because they knew who he was. It was a probation violation. So this isn't something where he was arrested somewhere and gave him a fake name. Right.
But one of the independent investigator, J.D. Cash, from a Curtin Gazette in southeastern Oklahoma, called Jesse Trinidad, Kenny's brother, the attorney, and went down the line as far as all of the uncanny resemblance, the physical attributes, the tattoos, everything that was actually, if they were looking for John Doe number two, one of McVeigh's aliases used in bank robberies to allegedly fund the bombing. So the federal authorities saw Kenny, and it's like he was a straight, dead-on image, a stunt double of one of the guys that was still one of the others unknown. Even though the indictments were dropped, they were still looking for these guys. I mean, it was a cacophony of complete miscommunication, deceit, hubris, arrogance, and Kenny was caught in the middle of all that, and unfortunately he perished at the hands of these people that wanted only McVeigh and Nichols.
Yeah, and he was a short timer problems. Even for his violation. He wouldn't have been there long.
Exactly. He would have been in and out within a week. So it was we got to know Jesse. In fact, our first commercial theater screening was in Salt Lake City in March of 2012. The film released in December of 2011, and Jesse walked us through what he and his family had gone through. I could pick up the phone and call him. I mean, he's a close friend of a lot of us on the crew. He's like family to us. And we cried, we laughed, we went through the whole gamut of what you do to put a movie like this together. And I would trust him with my life. He's just an amazing individual. And we were just absolutely honored to have the opportunity to interview him.
Now, you know, people talk about 9/11 quite a bit. I don't think they realize the importance. They really don't realize the fundamental importance that this played out, that this event played out. I mean, we have now proof from plenty of professionals that the bomb itself, that the official report says did all the damage, could not have done the damage. I want to address that, and I know that you're a little bit short on time for today, but I'm glad that we're getting this out on the anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. First of all, you know, my heart goes out to anyone who suffered loss of life. You know,
absolutely.
We don't want to.
We did this in a
I don't want. And you've never done anything but that, and I want to make that clear to everybody. What my position on this is quite simple. We weren't told the truth, and those people are being dishonored because right now the official story that's being put out, I consider bigger disrespect to them than to anyone else because they're being honored on a lie and not being honored on the truth. And I think that is seriously important. So, there was Trenadue. There was also, the Clinton files.
Sergeant Yankee?
The Clinton files, okay. The Whitewater.
Okay.
And now, was it purported that the Whitewater investigation files, were in that building? As well as evidence regarding MENA, Arkansas, and other things. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Okay, yes, I can. We had a retired Secret Service agent from Little Rock confide with us that the Clintons were actually due to be indicted and go before a joint House and Senate subcommittee on corruption in May of 1995. It was scheduled, I believe, for May 20. So we're talking about a month after the bombing had happened. The Clintons were going to be called on the carpet, and their political career would have been completely destroyed and torpedoed and gone by probably the end of June, if not July of 1995. They would not have been they would have been processed through the federal prison system. It was that bad.
Amazing how many times they've made it.
Right. And, you know, Teflon Don, like the mafia, well, that's the way Hillary Clinton was and Bill, too. But anyway, we weren't able to recover the documents or anything from the building, but we do have proof that there were CIA documents in there in the building.
I saw them on the ground.
We did have a
confidential. I saw the. Yeah.
Yes, we saw the clip that we found out from the Streets Department manager, who ironically issued us several permits for leafleting and trying to get feedback to see if our film would even be a viable project. He was a new employee with Oklahoma City at the time of the bombing, and he told us exactly what the FBI did. Commandeered some of the brand new street sweepers, and they were friends.
They kept any weapons or explosives in the building.
Within 6 to 7 blocks away from the burglary.
Day one, hour two of the bombing, the most significant event that happened is when they said they found other bombs in the building. The second most significant event was that they moved everybody back and held them back. There were still people alive trapped in the building.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Did you know that neither the American Medical Association nor the American Bar Association were established to benefit the American people? Have you recognized that in our country, health care has little to do with health and that our court system has nothing to do with justice? The priests of both medicine and law have been incentivized to implement a dark agenda on behalf of the Bilderbergers and their ilk. To protect ourselves and our progeny, we need to take a much closer look at how these two giant industries really work. Join me, Al Whitney, on In Defense of Humanity, Saturdays at 7 p.m. Central, as we expose the matrix and learn how not to consent to our own destruction.
It happens more often than we can imagine. In my case, I was sitting at home, and out of nowhere, I just started feeling uncomfortable. Then it got worse, and I started perspiring. I tried to ignore it, but I waited too long. The chest pain came as we were driving to the hospital emergency. I felt my life clock begin to tick. I barely survived. There was lots of damage done to my heart. What do I do now? I was lucky. I took a leap of faith and tried a 7-herb formula with hawthorn, garlic, cayenne, and more called Extendivite. Herbs have been used for thousands of years to keep us healthy. If you're not using Extendivite as a preventative supplement, maybe it's time to start. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
But they came in with two trucks and backed them up to the Murrah building, and a bunch of these guys dressed in blue jackets with no letters on the back started taking boxes of files out and putting them on this truck.
We were told by a blonde female agent that there were files so serious to the government that until those files were located, there would not be any recovery effort.
If you remember the Whitewater investigation in Arkansas, all the paperwork was stored in the Murrah building. They had FBI agents over in the fields to the west of the Murrah building picking up paper almost all day long.
And it was during this time that early in the investigation that I started receiving some various phone calls. One of them was a phone call from Little Rock, Arkansas. The guy said that he was a federal agent. He was not an FBI agent. He was not ATF. But what he did say was during their investigation of the Clintons, on all the drug running that went through Mena, Arkansas, and you know Lassiter's Ranch, and all of that stuff that was going on at the time during Iran-Contra, that those records, when Clinton went to Washington, were transferred from there to the Murrah building.
Because of the additional bomb threats, or because the building was unstable and the firefighters couldn't get to them. So those are a lot of patients I think were lost that could have been saved.
That in and of itself completely disproves that ANFA was used, because those documents wouldn't have been that far away. That's another conversation for another time. All right, as far as the damage.
The damaged Murrah building drew the attention of retired General Benton K. Parton, former director of the Air Force Armaments Laboratory. General Parton spent his career conducting bomb damage analysis with explosives for the military. General Parton came to Oklahoma City, examined the available evidence, and rendered a conclusion far different than the story being pandered by the government and media.
I spent over 30 years in the Air Force. Most of that was in research and development. I went to a two-year graduate program, 8 quarters of armament engineering graduates, first course that was ever set up. And after that, I worked at the Blissey Research Laboratories at Aberdeen, which was 2 years of hands-on work designing, developing continuous rod warhead for the Blue Martin missile and other weapon systems. Well, the truck bomb, even though it was fairly massive, was somewhat removed from some of the structures that were damaged. They clearly had some what you call Broussant's damage, where the blast pressure was way above what you would expect to get from the truck at that distance.
Broussant's damage is that caused by an explosive whose blast wave is powerful enough to shatter and destroy the material affected. The problem with the failed columns at the Murrah Building is at that distance, the air blast from an Anvil bomb would have been 10 times less powerful than what was needed to dissolve the concrete and cut the rebar. Those columns, had they failed due to air blast, should have broken with sharp chunks of concrete connected by rebar, not sheared off at critical points. Broussant's damage indicates contact explosives placed directly on the beams. Even more perplexing is the total collapse of column B3, which caused the floors on the east side to pancake onto one another. The building was gutted to within feet of the other side. Column B4, closer to the truck bomb, is completely intact. Yet we are supposed to believe that a blast wave traveled through B4, leaving the sheetrock almost untouched, and completely destroyed the column farther away. And most of the front columns were destroyed when the supporting header beam failed. But the cause of failure, supposedly being air blast, should have thrown it into the building. Instead, it fell straight down and rolled towards the crater. General Parton's report was conclusive. The Murrah Federal Building was not destroyed by one sole truck bomb. The major factor in its destruction appears to have been detonation of explosives carefully placed at 4 critical junctures on supporting columns within the building. Many independent experts concurred with the Parton report. Sam Cohen, inventor of the neutron bomb, issued this statement. I believe that the demolition charges in the building that were placed inside at certain key concrete columns did the primary damage to the Murrah Federal Building. It would have been absolutely impossible and against the laws of nature for a truck full of fertilizer and oil, no matter how much was used, to bring the building down. The FBI put all their weight behind the lone bomber theory and tailored the evidence to fit that scenario. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, a supervisor at the FBI crime lab, turned whistleblower over the Bureau's handling of the evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing.
Released a report today condemning the FBI crime lab for mishandling evidence and for slanting its analysis. The report is expected to specifically criticize the lab's handling of the Oklahoma City and World Trade Center bombing cases. It was the allegations of FBI whistleblower Frederick Whitehurst that sparked that investigation.
Forced to resign, Dr. Whitehurst testified in Terry Nichols' trial that a fellow FBI chemist had changed his findings and lied under oath after meeting with federal prosecutors. The Office of the Inspector General, or OIG, investigated Whitehurst's charges and issued a report which concluded that the FBI crime lab had improperly identified the characteristics of ANFO, the weight of the bomb, the detonation system, and even what kind of explosive was used.
The Oklahoma City case will get a lot of attention because what the Inspector General goes on to at some length to say in his analysis of agent testimony in some of the pre-trial stages is that one agent in particular made sort of seat of the pants estimates about the Oklahoma City bomb, but then couched them in his reports, in his written reports, as being the result of scientific evidence.
The FBI laboratory has billed itself for many, many years as the premier forensic laboratory in the world. The people that did the things they did knew doggone well what they were doing.
The Wright Armament Laboratory at Eglin Air Force Base conducted a series of explosive tests to compare their data to the bombing in Oklahoma. The Eglin test structure was a simple 3-story concrete slab building with no support columns. The engineers at Eglin tried to recreate the truck bomb as McVeigh and the FBI claimed it was constructed, with 4,000 pounds of ANFO packed into a dozen barrels. But they found that each barrel acted as a separate bomb, canceling out the explosive force of each other and pushing most of the blast upwards. So they constructed a single more powerful bomb and exploded it outside the target building to test the effects of air blast. They found that their weaker test structure suffered less damage from a more powerful bomb than was supposedly used at Oklahoma City. The report for the Wright Laboratory at Eglin Air Force Base concluded, the damage at the Murrah Federal Building is not the result of the truck bomb itself, but rather due to other factors such as locally placed charges within the building. The evidence is undeniable, despite the pleas of the official story, that the Wright truck bomb was not the sole cause of destruction that day, that there were bombs placed inside the building, which caused the brunt of casualties as floors collapsed on helpless victims.
Here's what we do know, that there were 23 devices in the building. 23, not one, not two, not 10.
And how do we, three explain to the audience how you know that number?
Because of the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad. Again, remember, we're talking local authorities, mm-hmm. local experts, had their friends, close associates, some family members that were either severely injured, came within an inch of their life, or were perished in the bombing. They had a vested interest in making sure that they knew what the truth was. Regardless of what the federal authorities told them to do, they were bound and determined to find out what happened. And thank God we were able to lock arms and lockstep and be allies with these people. They're the ones that fed us a lot of the information. Two trusted sources, a former medic for the Oklahoma County Bomb Squad and one of their agents mm-hmm. told us that when they walked into the Murrah Building within 45 minutes after the bombing, they saw 23 devices on the support columns mm-hmm. on all nine floors. Not one, not the first or second floor, not just the basement, but
the whole
all
thing
floors.
Was intended to go out, but a couple of the blasts.
Yes. Three of them went off at 9:02, and I asked one of the agents, I says, and even corroborated this with somebody from Tinker Air Force Base, I says, why 9:02? And he says, because that's textbook clandestine military operation, regardless of a CIA, military
Mossad,
intelligence. You go in, you go in and you set the charges. You give yourself 2 minutes to get your rear end out of the building so you don't kill yourself. Go time is 9:00. You set it for 2 minutes after. You're out of there, and you're long gone, and then just all hell breaks loose. That's why the initial series of explosions went off at 9:02. We do know from 14 different witnesses, nine of them on the top floor in the middle of a Windows 95. Now, remember, this is April 95. Beta testing of Windows already was completed. The market already had Windows 95 out. And there was a class on the ninth floor with several HUD employees, including the supervisor, that were going through mm-hmm. this training class. And they felt the building shake 5 to 8 seconds before the bomb even blew the windows in. They had the wherewithal, the cognitive ability to go under their desks before the plate glass was blown in. If, in fact, they did not do that, they would have been impaled and pinned up against
right, now
the wall.
Now, this goes to, now, I remember speaking to a couple people about this, and one of which I really want, this is one of the reasons why I'd really like to have Gary and you discuss this, is because there was, apparently, there was seismic readings that showed different explosions. Now, I've heard people say that they, you know, Gary even said he went back and he spoke to the seismologist and he's got this explanation for it. And I really, it sounds legitimate, but when you take that evidence and you compare it to testimony of people that felt the rumble and could get under their desk in time to, you know, for the second round to come, you know, it just, I don't know. And what about the Army General, made it really kind of clear. Was he a general or was he a scientist? General, right?
General Benton Parton. He was a one-star brigadier general with the U.S. Air Force. He was the head of the Pentagon Armament Lab for at least mm-hmm. 18 years. This is an individual. Now, put things in perspective. I flew out to his home in October 2003, had a wonderful meeting with him. He invited me to stay overnight, which I did. I was out there for 2 days and one night. And we sat at his dining room table after we had a steak dinner with his wife at Fort Belvoir. He took me to the officers' club. Beautiful dinner, had a nice discussion. We're driving by the Pentagon. Two things that happened here. There's seminal memory of just an absolutely wonderful individual. We're driving by the Pentagon. It's about 10:30 at night. And he's driving, and his wife is asleep in the back seat, and I'm in the front seat of his Cadillac. And he points over to his left over his left shoulder, and he says, "You see every light in the Pentagon?" And I said, "Yeah." And he says, "Well, for every light, there's one light that somebody's going to try to save this country and another light that somebody's going to try to tear it down." He says, "You have the yang and the yin."
Well, the truck bomb, even though it was fairly massive, was somewhat removed from some of the structures that were damaged. It clearly had some what you call Broussard's damage, where the blast pressure was way above what you would expect to get from the truck at that distance.
Broussard's damage is that caused by an explosive whose blast wave is powerful enough to shatter and destroy the material affected. The problem with the failed columns at the Murrah Building is at that distance, the air blast from an Anvil bomb would have been 10 times less powerful than what was needed to dissolve the concrete and cut the rebar. Those columns, had they failed due to air blast, should have broken with sharp chunks of concrete connected by rebar, not sheared off at critical points. Broussard's damage indicates contact explosives placed directly on the beams. Even more perplexing is the total collapse of column B3, which caused the floors on the east side to pancake onto one another. The building was gutted to within feet of the other side. Column B4, closer to the truck bomb, is completely intact. Yet we are supposed to believe that a blast wave traveled through B4, leaving the sheetrock almost untouched, and completely destroyed the column farther away. And most of the front columns were destroyed when the supporting header beam failed. But the cause of failure, supposedly being air blast, should have thrown it into the building. Instead, it fell straight down and rolled towards the crater. General Parton's report was conclusive. The Murrah Federal Building was not destroyed by one sole truck bomb. The major factor in its destruction appears to have been detonation of explosives carefully placed at four critical junctures on supporting columns within the building. Many independent experts concurred with the Parton report. Sam Cohen, inventor of the neutron bomb, issued this statement. "I believe that the demolition charges in the building that were placed inside at certain key concrete columns did the primary damage to the Murrah Federal Building. It would have been absolutely impossible and against the laws of nature for a truck full of fertilizer and oil, no matter how much was used, to bring the building down." The FBI put all their weight behind the lone bomber theory and tailored the evidence to fit that scenario. Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, a supervisor at the FBI crime lab, turned whistleblower over the Bureau's handling of the evidence in the Oklahoma City bombing.
"Released a report today condemning the FBI crime lab for mishandling evidence and for slanting its analysis. The report is expected to specifically criticize the lab's handling of the Oklahoma City and World Trade Center bombing cases. It was the allegations of FBI whistleblower Frederick Whitehurst that sparked that investigation."
And eventually to the desk of the president. That's what General Parton did professionally for 18 years. He knew what it took to take down a building such as the Murrah Building. And you know what he told me? It was 2 weeks after the bombing. He gets a copy of Newsweek. And there it is on the front cover. The ripped out, gutted out photo, aerial photo, taken by Channel 9 from ABC affiliate in Tulsa from their helicopter. Newsweek bought the rights to that, one of the still photos. And he pounded his fist down on the coffee table with that Newsweek magazine sitting there, and he says, "BS." I'm not going to say what he actually is. He was very upset, and he says, "I'll be darned if these people are going to be lied about." And again, he refused to remember the deaths of these people in a lie. Gets on the phone an hour later with Representative Charles Key at the state capitol, who was trying to do an independent investigation. Charles Key, within a month after the bombing, was going to hold a press conference and say, "Okay, you know what? Federal government's offering one version," and it was his official announcement that he was impaneling a independent committee and pleaded with the Oklahoma County grand jury to help him do an independent investigation. Guess who shows up at that press conference? Volunteered his own time, General Parton, retired military, Pentagon employee. He knew that Charles is on the right track, and I was just in awe to sit across from him. We got home at about, I think it was around 11. We sat up to almost 3 o'clock in the morning. So we're there for 4 hours. And it's like sitting across the table from Einstein. We rolled out a legal pad, and I still have them in the archives. Photocopied, and I have some on the Facebook page for the film. Photocopied all the formulas and the diagrams and all of his explanation. 7 pages full of this stuff. Blast wave attenuation. I knew some of it, having gone to college as an engineering student. I understood the basic tenets of what he was telling me. I just sat there and I'm thinking, wow, how did I get here? And how in the world am I getting to speak to this guy? I had so much respect for him.
Well, you know, it's good to know that there are some real American patriots still left in there. I mean, we're seeing some dark times going on. It's when they step up. And, you know, people say, you know, not enough people from the government stand up. They stand up all the time.
No, absolutely. Yes, and I can attest to that. And I do want to let your viewers know, we did have the honest and genuine support of local, county, state, and federal law enforcement, private investigators. We interviewed the crew, 326 individuals, victims, family members, survivors, law enforcement, private investigators, military personnel, active and retired. Some of the former top brass at the airbase helped us. The head of the copy in the photo lab in the airbase, who gave us photos that the FBI didn't even have access to when the search and rescue and search and recovery canine crews were debriefed at the airbase. We had access to all of their photos. It was unbelievable. And I'm not bragging here, but it's like, this is the cachet of information we had to go with. So for anybody to sit here and say, well, you know, they just found this stuff on the internet in their dad's basement, This took 8.5 years to put this together.
Just the other day, just to give you, for instance, and this is really frustrating to me, I saw a video hit piece on that was used to discredit one of these things. I'm not even really going to give this guy any attention, but using a Wikipedia article to try and debunk, and it's just the laziness.
I'm speechless.
Yeah, that's the laziness that a lot of people have come to. That it's, if somebody makes a video or makes an allegation or whether writes an article, and they go off of Wikipedia or Snopes or, you know, and that's the extreme. There's plenty of publications from that extreme to the middle. But when I saw this one piece, and it was how can you sit there and it just doesn't compute in my brain. You know, these people, they read these things, they don't research them, they don't look at any of the facts, they don't read any of the documents. When I talk about a case, when I talk to you about the case of Schaefer Cox and Jeffrey Winehouse, I've read the case reports, I've watched the testimony, I've reviewed the evidence. I don't go off half-cocked supporting somebody just because they were conservative-ish and so am I and I think they were wrong. I really looked into this.
Right.
And the people involved, when you start scratching through that surface, And you see the players involved. Timothy McVeigh himself, sheep dipped. James Corbett, I think, did a really interesting piece. I don't know if I agree with everything in it or not, but I respect the presentation he made was reasonable. There was nothing unreasonable.
And I was honored to be on that. We did, I believe, that in April of 2015. 2 days ago, I was on a radio show with him, with Ricky Brandis, and I says, I have the utmost respect for James and what he's done. He's phenomenal. He lives in Japan. He's a Canadian citizen, teaches English as a second language, and is a phenomenal researcher and radio show host. But you're right. And I do want to say this. Thank you for inviting me on this show. Thank you for the work that you do, because we're all in this together. I mean, either we survive together or we sing together, you know?
And it's duty. And what Brian, my friend Brian and I have been trying to talk to people about, really so important, is to break free of the left-right paradigm. Now, I'm conservative. I don't hide that in my traditional values and things like that. But when it comes to freedom, I'm pro-freedom conservative. Not, when I look at Republicans today, I see neoconservatives that are just traditional flavored Trotskyites. That's all they are to me. They're warmongers. I'm an anti-war conservative. I don't believe in entangling alliances with other nations. I hate to say it, I know a lot of conservatives support the nation of Israel. Billions and billions of dollars of redistribution of American wealth is not making America great again. This is not pro or anti-bashing anybody.
I believe in applying
one's values across the board. If I believe in private property rights for me and for ranchers and for farmers and, you know, the quintessential values of conservatism, private property rights, the right to pursue happiness without infringing upon the rights of others, how can I not also apply that? Regardless of people's religion, see, people get caught up in the in all of the distractions, and they don't apply their principles. I believe in applying principles over party. Right. And one thing that I noticed in your films, it doesn't seem to be real politically choosing a side, but just choosing the facts. And yeah,
that's what we try to do. Stay academic, go right down the middle of the road. And you know what? The ultimate, I don't know if I share this with you, University of California, Berkeley, University of Wisconsin, Madison. I mean, you talk about liberal colleges. I went to Madison for a while. Then we had Oklahoma State University, their flagship campus in Stillwater. University of Oklahoma did have us there, but they didn't do the screening of the film, but they hosted a conference that we put on. Florida Atlantic University in Boca Raton, conservative, and Clayton State University, 20 miles south of Atlanta. We would have both the conservative side and the liberal colleges, both of them giving us a two thumbs up. That was the ultimate compliment, and we were shocked. It's like, wow, okay, I guess that was our goal, to try to reach the broad spectrum, and hopefully we did a good job.
You did, and pointing the light on what's happened in this to the militia movement as well, because I'm a supporter in our old-fashioned traditions. I don't know where people got the crazy idea that they could form a well-regulated militia for the defense of themselves and their neighbors. Wow, what a concept, what a radical revolutionary concept, right? But I believe in these tenets, and I believe that's how you keep your freedom. So I do believe in militias. But one thing that I've noticed, and again, I know it kind of falls back to people like the Southern Poverty Law Center, the actual amount of who they consider to be neo-Nazi white supremacists, their numbers are so small in relation to the broader conservative or, I mean, you look at Antifa on the other side, but they're really so small. So they have to infiltrate, foment. This is what they did. They created entire militias that were fake. I mean, entire whole militias were fake, and tried gravitating all of the nuttiest people that they could find to gravitate to them to present. And we see the federal government, even when, you know, when it comes to the Boston bombing thing, what it really bothers me more than anything else about all of that case, I don't make allegations or claims that I can't prove. One thing that bothers me, though, is when the aunt said, well, the FBI had been in touch with my nephews for years. For years?
Exactly. Yes. We know for at least 2.5, not 3 years. And then the field office agent in Boston is saying, well, you know, we really had no knowledge. It's like, oh, crap. You guys, you were tailing it. They were taking them out to dinner and funding some of their offices.
I'm wondering if I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to speculate, but.
But that's another.
Yeah, that's another conversation for another time. It is, for sure. And your other projects. One question I want to ask, though, I did want to ask. I used to be a big Alex Jones fan. A lot of the stuff he was putting out standing against the United Nations, against the communists, against all the other things that were going on.
Sure.
As of recent things, and I'm not talking about the thing from the town from up north that we can't talk about that incident because everybody gets censored. I'm not talking about the lawsuit. A lot of things that he doesn't tell people kind of bothers me. I know that my viewers are going to be a little bit critical because they will see him occasionally in your films. And, and I want to tell people, you know, that it's not, I don't have a particular gripe except for what we're not told by certain networks. And everybody has their own thing. People that have gone so invested into Trump and his identity, and one of the reasons why I worship no leader, I don't care whether you can go all the way back, any president, I wasn't really crazy after Abe Lincoln, so I don't like any of them, because that's my job, is to keep their feet to the fire. It's not my job to worship
my physical, emotional well-being. I'm skeptical as most people about products and their claims, and I never write reviews, but this is a wonderful product, and I recommend it to everyone. Great product. It has brought my blood pressure from the mid-150s over the 80s to the mid-130s over mid-80s. Along with diet and exercise in just the past couple of months. Excellent. Thank you, David. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-928-8822.